Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Vertical Space, a podcast at the intersection of technology and flight. We are your hosts, Jim Barry and Luka Tomjanovic, and here we look at the most important forces shaping the market of advanced air mobility, with a particular focus on why and how they matter to those building a business in this very exciting and growing industry.
Those are one of the things that I'm trying to change, because there are a growing, concerning number of cases in which GPS is being attacked or GPS is being denied for intentional reasons or non-intentional reasons, and we all have to prepare for that day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Vertical Space. So today we're talking about Global Navigation Satellite Systems, or GNSS, and in particular, its vulnerabilities to jamming and spoofing. Joining us in the conversation is Omer Sharar, CEO of Infinidome, a GPS security company based in Israel. As a society, we come to rely on GPS for countless things we do every day, to determine a position, to navigate whether it's on the ground, at sea, or in the air, to track our packages, use maps, and determine precise and accurate timing. At the same time, we've come to accept it's almost a given, and most of us are not even aware of the vulnerabilities of GPS. So that's what this episode is about. We discuss what happens when a GPS signal is jammed, how easy it is to jam a GPS signal, how often it happens, and who cares about it. Omer shines light on the demand signals in the defense and civil markets, where the pain point is most acute, how big a risk GPS jamming poses to drone operations at scale, and importantly, how to deal with this risk. Omer also talks about how the FAA and EASA think about GPS jamming as a threat to safety, how the industry is solving GPS denied navigation, and also what kind of GPS jamming is happening in the war in Ukraine. Enjoy the conversation with Omer right after our sponsor message.
This episode of the Vertical Space podcast is brought to you by UAvionics. UAvionics is the leader in low size, weight, and power certified avionics for manned, unmanned, and advanced air mobility aircraft. Let UAvionics help you achieve your goals, whether that be type certification, airspace access, or beyond visual line of sight operations. UAvionics has certified and certifiable communications, navigation, and surveillance avionics for your aircraft. So head over to uavionics.com or Google it to see how you can start flying safer and move your platform forward into shared airspace.
Omer Sharar is co-founder and CEO of Infinidome. Leveraging his deep knowledge and experience in the GPS timing and synchronization world, Omer co-founded Infinidome in 2016 with the goal of creating GPS protection and resilient navigation solutions defending drones, vehicles, fleets, and other critical assets from jamming and spoofing attacks. Omer was head of synchronization division at Focus Telecom, designing GPS and atomic clocks-based solutions for customers in Israel and out of it. Before that, he was a control system architect at Utilite Solar Printing Systems and head of software and control R&D team at HP SciTex. Omer holds a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics and Computer Science from Ben-Gurion University and an MBA in International Business from the IDC Herzliya. Omer, welcome to the Vertical Space. It's great to have you, and please meet Luka Tomjanovic.
Hi, thank you very much, Jim and Luka, for the opportunity to speak in the Vertical Space podcast. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Omer.
Is there anything that very few in the industry agree with you on?
I think that one of the things that I try, it'll sound a little bit condescending, but I try to educate everybody, is that GPS is not a God-given right. Most of the industry, doesn't matter if it's in the defense, homeland security, or commercial industry, looking at GPS a little bit like oxygen. It's just there. That's one of the things that I'm trying to change, that people will not take it for granted.
But talk a little bit more about that. That's terrific. And you're right. You simply assume with the introduction to GPS, we've gotten so used to it and so much of what we do. What they disagree with you on is that they simply assume it's always going to be there. And what you're saying is you can't count on it.
Yeah, correct. I think the DHS has analyzed that there are about 16 different sectors that are considered critical to the U.S. industry. If I remember correctly, about 11 of those depend directly on GPS or GNSS, and the rest depend on it indirectly. This ranges between telecom, ranges all the way to power industry, the transportation industry, the delivery industry, and everything that's in, and of course, defense and everything in between. Problem is that all of the different sectors are treating GPS again, it's just there because it works, because why wouldn't it work? And those are one of the things that I'm trying to change, because there are a growing, concerning number of cases in which GPS is being attacked or GPS is being denied for intentional reasons or non-intentional reasons. And we all have to prepare for that day. And especially when you're sitting in the middle of a city somewhere in the United States, you don't see that happening because it didn't happen until now, because we didn't have enough applications out there that basically crash when their GNSS is being denied. That is what we disagree on. That is what I'm trying to change. People to start to get to start thinking about that.
You know, it's interesting how dependent our lives and our society has become on GPS. I don't know if my recollection is right. Correct me if I'm wrong there. But I remember reading somewhere that in the early history of GPS, while it was still being approved and developed, it almost got shut down because whoever was arguing for the project only envisioned 6 or 9 use cases. I can't remember off the top of my head. And then, you know, it risked being scrubbed because of the perceived lack of relevance to broadly the industry. And now you fast forward and we're so dependent on it, it's unbelievable.
I agree. I mean, in the beginning, a receiver was the size of a small room and then required the power being fed from a power facility. But also the evolution of GPS is very interesting. In the beginning, when GPS was out in the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, it had something called selective availability, SA, which basically said that only military users will have a special code that will allow it to become very, very accurate. What happened, I think it was in the first Gulf War, the American forces and their allies started using commercial GPSs. And when that GPS was disrupted with, basically to try to enable only friendly forces to have GPS, it really screwed up with everybody's GPS. And I think since then, I think it was back then, it was Bill Clinton that came back and said, we're going to make GPS available and accurate for everybody all the time. But obviously, the other superpowers could not count on that happening. And that's why the other superpowers, like Russia, founded their own GPS system called GLONASS. The Europeans founded their system called Galileo. The Chinese, their Baidu. But basically now we're looking at these tiny receivers that implement amazing technology based on Einstein's theory of relativity, costing about $2, incredibly accurate and fast, able to receive close to 100 different satellites at the same time. So the evolution here is unbelievable. But yes, because this technology has become unbelievably available and accurate, it's basically like a thread that is being weaved through everywhere and all of the technology that we found ourselves dependent on. And when that thread is cut, that's when things start crippling down one after the other.
So tell us about the main vulnerability of GNSS systems in general.
Sure. Well, we have to remember a little bit like what are the basic principles of GPS. So GPS, again, the American system, but exactly in the same way as GLONASS and Beidou and Galileo, contains a few tens of satellites, between 24 and 30-something satellites that are orbiting in what's called MEO, Middle Earth Orbit, at around 20,000 kilometers above ground level. And the signals, when they are emitted from that distance, when they are received here on Earth, it doesn't matter if it's on my phone, if it's on a UAV, if it's on a toy drone, or if it's on a car or a truck or critical infrastructure, it's the same signal strength. And it's incredibly weak. I always say that it's about the equivalent strength received from a 20-watt light bulb you light up in California and try to receive its signal in New York. That's about how weak GPS signals are, GNSS signals are. It's exactly the same frequencies used, or very close to the same frequencies used between the different satellite systems. Now, the problem with that very, very vulnerable signal, incredibly easy to overpower it. All you have to do is to transmit something, anything really, in the same frequency, slightly more powerful than how you're receiving, or the power that you're receiving GPS, the GPS signal in. Meaning that basically today, you can buy GPS jammers online at various websites, usually coming from China, for as little as $20. It's about the size of a USB stick or slightly larger than that, maybe a very small battery. It has a little button on the side and an antenna. And when you click that button, basically create a denial of service attack that can jam or disrupt the GPS signal, and basically creates a little bit like a blackout that affects, as a function of how powerful your jammer is, everything that's around you. So it doesn't matter if it's a phone, if it's a drone, if it's a car or critical infrastructure, its GPS goes away incredibly quickly.
The $20 jammer that you mentioned, how powerful of a jammer can we expect at such a low cost, and what kind of coverage?
For $20 to $50, you can buy roughly a 0.2 watt jammer. Can have either one antenna affecting L1 frequency, you know, around 1.575 gigahertz, or a two antenna jammer that can affect both L1 and L2. And just to translate that, 0.2 watts will get you a blackout of GPS affecting a radius of approximately 100 meters around you. And obviously, some applications and some receivers are more vulnerable and more sensitive than others. Usually it's a function of how accurate you want that application to be. You know, the more accurate, the more sensitive it is to these kinds of disruptions. But the thing is that you can amplify that same jammer very, very easily. All you have to do is to disconnect the antenna. You can buy amplifiers that are actually legal to buy because they just amplify signal. And you can make that 100 meter radius into half a mile.
Can you give us examples, Omer, of how GPS jamming affect commercial and military today? And sure. I would assume this is something they've already anticipated, you know, whether it be the Amazon or whether it be an airline or whether it be the U.S. military. I assume they anticipated this 15 years ago when they saw the potential dependency on GPS, and they planned accordingly.
Yeah, sure. I'll start with military. One of the things that they found is that the easiest way to actually get, so I'm specifically talking about now drones and UAVs, the easiest way to actually operate them and get them not only to get from point A to point B, but to stabilize and to be able to hold their position and to be able to carry out any kind of reconnaissance missions or border patrol missions. It's basically to have them base a lot of their logic and their control on GPS, on their GNSS receiver, because of its incredible accuracy. But the thing is that why do we care? Because and I think the greatest way is to actually see this in action. When you take an average multicopter, an average, what we call drone, and you have it perform a very basic functionality, which is, take off. It's called position hold. It's a command that basically says, hold your position and hold your height right now. And you take a jammer. It can be a military grade jammer. It can be a small jammer, a little bit amplified. And you flick it on from about, 50 meter distance. What you're seeing is incredible. You're seeing that drone take an immediate angle very aggressively, and then start taking off incredibly quickly, drifting off tens and hundreds of meters within, less than a minute. This is the easiest way to take down a drone. Actually, a really interesting use case that I found quite recently for people to use these jammers is to steal drones. So they operate these jammers in the northern part of Israel, where people are flying drones. It could be military, it can be commercial. They're using GPS jammers to make the drones fall into the ground, and they steal them. They've become completely dependent on GPS. Attack their GPS, deny their GPS, compromise the integrity of that GPS, take away their capability to perform their mission, and sometimes, a lot of the times, even have the platform crash into the ground. That is in the military space. The commercial space, when we're talking about vehicles, and it's interesting, in the early days of our company, we were looking head on into the great autonomous vehicle industry that was imminent. Unfortunately, that has been pushed off several times. But, when we're talking about a vehicle on the ground and you have its GPS being denied or compromised, in the worst case, it stops at the side of the road. But when you're talking about a drone, either in logistic missions, right, carrying parcels from point A to point B, you mentioned Amazon Prime, you mentioned Google Wing, you mentioned, Flightrex and Matternet, DroneUp and Mana Drones are fantastic companies out there, but they have a great challenge on their hands because they are there in order to be able to replace the delivery guy on the moped or on the little scooter, So by definition, they have to be able to create vehicles, aerial vehicles, as low costing to, you know, make and to operate as possible, still safe enough to be able to carry out their missions. And like in military, they depend very, very heavily on GNSS to be able to do so. So again, just like in military, take away their capability to receive GPS by denying it using a jammer. You take away not only their ability to complete their missions, but probably you find a very, very easy way to bring it hurling into the ground.
How often do we see jamming occurring in the commercial applications?
So that's a very, very good question. That was asked in approximately 2018 for the first time in a formal way. And the first ones who actually did something about that was the EU. Now, the European Union assembled a task force called Strike 3, which basically went out and spread about 40 antennas, stationary antennas, across Europe, Western Europe. And their entire mission for about a year and a half was only to collect data to try to answer that question. How often do we see GPS jamming attacks, either intentional or non-intentional? I'll get to the difference between the two in a second. How often do we see them in the civilian world? And they found that the answer was very surprising. They found about 60,000 high-powered GPS jamming attacks from these 40 stationary antennas. This is not the total number of attacks that happened during there. It's just the attacks that they found over the course of about a year and a half. That translates to hundreds of attacks every day in those countries. This was in 2018, 2019, if I'm not mistaken.
Was this throughout the European Union?
Correct. Western Europe. This is not Russia, Ukraine right now, which is a different story entirely. This is Western Europe. And the problem, and you know, from here to here and again, we're seeing an article that basically says, you know, we saw this occurrence that affected that area or that application in different areas. So there are a few organizations that are trying to track this. One of them is the Coast Guard. The U.S. Coast Guard has actually a database that has to try to log information from users on these GPS attacks they're seeing in the field. But much like them, there are other organizations like RNT FND, the Resilient Navigation and Timing Foundation, that again collects a lot of information on these different incidences around the world and tries to compile them and give information about them.
So these 100 jamming instances per day, how do they materialize? What were the consequences?
Usually what we're seeing this is we're seeing our Waze or our Google Maps application inaccurate or inactive in an area for some reason. And this is how it really affects, you know, you and I. But if we're looking a little bit, you know, one click higher than that, and we're looking at critical assets, for example. So there were many cases that critical assets were completely disabled because of these GPS attacks. So there's a very known case back in 2012 where a truck driver used a GPS jammer to hide from his boss, drove and delivered, I don't remember exactly what he delivered, but some kind of commodity into Newark Airport. He used the GPS jammer to hide from his boss. So every time he drove into the airport, he actually caused critical plane landing ground systems to be impaired and to be maybe not completely disabled, but definitely to function not well. This is after 2 weeks, they found the source of this problem and he got slapped with a fine. But obviously, that situation has to be thought of and taken care of.
Right. I remember reading about that. And these 100, roughly 100 attacks per day, on average, what's the coverage? Are these very localized? Are these broad area? And are they intentional or unintentional? What's the split?
So usually today, these attacks are relatively low powered. I wouldn't say very low powered because otherwise they wouldn't categorize them back then as high powered. I wouldn't say they're you know, affecting a radius of miles and miles. But usually they're the result of people using personal jammers. The reason why these jammers became a $20 product on the Chinese websites is because people buy them for their own privacy reasons. They're trying to hide from their boss, from their spouse, from the government, from Big Brother. And they're doing so by buying this personal GPS jamming device to hide their own location. What they don't realize is that it affects not only their own location, but everything that's based on GPS around them. So usually that could translate into 100 meters around you, of things being compromised in GPS. It could be momentarily, right? It could be that you have a very critical asset that's stationary and a truck driver driving by, and for 10 seconds you don't have GPS. Big deal, right? But what happens if that truck driver is by accident parking next to your antenna? Actually, I think it was in California that there was a case that there was a certain casino somewhere that a lot of truck drivers like to stop by, and they didn't like their boss being able to see that they stopped at that casino. So they use GPS jamming consistently when stopping by there. As a result, critical systems around them, you can see trends actually being suffered by according to when the casino's operating hours and when there was a lot of truck driver traffic over there.
At the end of the day, what you're saying to some degree, Omer, is, you know, 10 years ago, GPS was supplementing the human who is making the decisions on, you know, when I'm flying or what I'm operating, what I'm driving. As we move more towards autonomy, GPS and GPS jamming now has catastrophic consequences in that, you know, even though there still could be a human involved, they're counting on the GPS and GPS navigation as their primary source of location and direction and navigation overall. As a result, it sounds like the ramifications for our industry are much more significant when it comes to GPS jamming.
I completely agree. Today, and if you're looking at the other side of the equation, right, how you protect from rogue drones, for example, every counter UAV weapon today starts with GPS jamming. Because it's vulnerability, it's the easiest factor, the easiest signal to be able to jam from as far as possible away. That is the first thing that you are trying to compromise when you're trying to disable or to bring down a drone from the air. I always call it the Achilles heel of every kind of application that we're building today. And you have to have that not only protected, but my approach, and maybe that's a little bit counterintuitive because, you know, our business is protecting GPS. Don't count only on GPS. You cannot create any kind of critical application. It doesn't matter if it's a drone delivering heart transplant, dinner, or people. You cannot have a single point of failure anywhere, especially when it comes down to having that platform stay up in the air or come hurtling into the ground.
So how is the industry dealing with these GPS vulnerabilities? One thing, as you hinted at, is don't rely on GPS alone. And I mean, I'm coming from the flying world, and it's really, really evident there that you don't really rely on it. There's ways to deal with the loss of GPS signal. There's backup systems like INS and some of the other navigational systems. So what is the industry's approach?
Well, it really depends on what platform we're talking about. So the traditional aerospace industry, as you mentioned, has been around even before GPS, and they usually use aerospace grade inertial navigation systems that basically allow you to perform a lot of the capabilities, almost all of the capabilities, even when GPS is being denied. And that is because, again, an INS gives you the ability to track movement and understand your position and be able to stabilize your system even when GPS goes away for a significantly long time. Especially, of course, if there's a pilot involved. The problem with an INS, especially when we're talking about lower end platform that cannot afford, you know, a $50,000 aerospace grade INS, when I'm talking about a drone that, you know, is very sensitive to what we call C-swap, cost, size, weight, and power considerations, is that even if they do have an INS, it drifts. It's a backup that drifts in terms of its ability to tell you its position. And it drifts not in a linear fashion, it drifts in an exponential fashion, which means that as a function of time, you're going to get a larger and larger error of where you're supposed to be. So it's only a very, very temporary solution. I think it's mandatory. It's very important, especially for momentary GPS disruptions, but that's how you need to treat it. So it's not a silver bullet. The other alternatives, the one that has grown to be very, very popular, is video-based navigation. A lot of these drones, a lot of these UAVs have cameras, and the cameras have been growing to be extremely high definition, high capability. And hey, you can navigate based on those cameras, and you can even navigate autonomously if you have a preloaded maps and if you have a good sense of where you need to go according to what you're going to see. But that's exactly one of the problems here, because these camera-based navigation capabilities are very limited to being able to actually see well. And that could be compromised when you are in glaring situations, you know, flying where you have a glare from the sun in dark. After the sun goes down, you have your vision very, very impaired. Sometimes you need anchors to be able to, as I said, preloaded maps, right? So you need to be able to navigate in a preloaded area. If you're going to an uncharted territory, you're going to be in problem. If you're going to be in an area that you don't have a lot of anchors, if you're flying over water or over a green field or over the desert, you're going to have a problem to navigate. So there are a lot of situations in which this video-based navigation approach is not good enough. But then you have other sensors, right? And we're seeing this in the autonomous vehicle industry, right? There's a huge buzzword now called sensor fusion. Let's take as many sensors as possible and try to fuse them together. I think that's a wonderful approach. But if you're looking at other sensors as well, for example, LiDAR-based navigation, radar-based navigation, and other types of alternative navigation capabilities, again, each and every one of them have caveats at which they don't work or don't work well. And that's why I believe that the best approach, and by the way, when these applications, these alternatives don't work well, that's when they revert right back to GPS. And if you don't have any kind of protection on that GPS, then that's exactly going to be your vulnerability. And that's when you're going to have your platform crash into the ground.
How many of the drone delivery service companies are counting on GPS as their primary source of navigation?
All of them.
How many of them have backup systems should the GPS as the primary fail?
So another approach, by the way, which I haven't gotten into, is maybe I won't be able to complete my mission, but I won't crash on the ground. For example, if my GPS is being compromised, I will take out my parachute and land softly on the ground.
I can't fulfill my mission. I can't complete my mission, but I won't have a catastrophic result.
Exactly. So definitely those are approaches that are important. Those are approaches that sometimes tell the regulators, you know, when there's a big problem like that in GPS, then, you know, I won't crash into the ground. I think, of course, that's a good approach. But it's not good enough because, again, that's not a solution for everything. But usually that's the approach that is being taken by the non-defense, non-government applications out there.
There's not 100 companies listening to this podcast right now saying, well, we don't use GPS anymore. You know, we've done something different than GPS because we know it can easily be jammed. So, you know, GPS is no longer our primary source of navigation. What you're saying is 99 out of 100 are using GPS as their primary source of navigation, and if it fails, they don't accomplish the mission. They don't fulfill the mission. They just find a way to have a non-catastrophic result.
Correct. Even if you're looking at how the drones are built today, by definition, you know, the world is divided into DJI, into PixHawk, which is a little bit like the Android of drones, and you have a few proprietary controllers that are very fundamentally similar to PixHawk. At the end of the day, the core functionality is to have NMEA, which is the positioning data, being fed to you continuously. And that today is being done almost entirely by GPS.
Let's say we're at an investor conference for one of these service delivery companies. Somebody gets up and says, so I understand that you use GPS as your primary source of navigation, but it can really easily be jammed. What is your business model if everybody's jamming, whether it be intentional or unintentional? What happens if we're all jamming the airspace? What would those people say today?
I'll try not to fly there. I think that's usually the case because they really cannot operate when GPS is being denied. Even in military, when you have more means and you're not that price sensitive or cost sensitive, you know, I'm having discussions with very, very high-end platforms that are saying, hey, you know, in a couple of years, we're not going to need GPS because we have all of these wonderful tens and hundreds of thousands worth of sensors that we can fuse. That's wonderful, I tell them. But at the end of the day, you're still going to need GPS because even the greatest INS in the world, a $50,000 INS, if you flick it on and you don't have GPS to get that initial lock, that INS is not worth it.
I also think, Jim, back to your question, that it's necessarily a question of a trade space, right? You can put a lot of interesting sensors on your drone that's supposed to be cheap and deliver a cheap and affordable service. But at the same time, you have to balance that with how often these kinds of problems arise. What are the consequences if they do arise? You know, in a normal, peaceful environment, there might be some random people who want to protect and have unintentional jamming, or perhaps some intentional, but very localized to protect their own privacies. But typically those are not large scope barrage jammers, which, oh, by the way, are very easy to detect. And, you know, law enforcement will do something about that.
I agree. Just to note on that, Luca, I completely agree. And if you're looking at the bill of material of most of the delivery drones, they're looking to, you know, be able to build an entire enterprise level delivery drone end to end for less than $5,000 a piece. And when you're that sensitive in terms of what you're able to put on in terms of weight and size and, of course, cost, then there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off because the economics of this entire business model of delivering stuff from point A to point B has to make sense. And the only way to make sense of it is if you drive down the prices of everything per delivery, per drone. And then it comes down to a risk assessment. And I've been receiving a lot of messages from the commercial side that, hey, if the regulators won't come to us and tell us, hey, you have to put that level of protection, we're not going to do anything, because it's a simple risk assessment insurance kind of approach, saying, you know, what is my risk here? How likely am I to get jammed? And maybe it's okay if one out of 1,000 flights crashes on somebody's head. Again, it's a consideration that they might be able to take.
These new constellations, whether this is GPS Block 3, the upgraded GPS system, or whether these are some of the upcoming constellations, how much of the GPS vulnerabilities will those new constellations and assets fix?
So GPS Block 3 is the newest capabilities of newest GPS satellites that they're launching. Yes, their signal is considerably more powerful than the original GPS signal, but that is still today very, very partial service. And even that could, you know, you need a slightly bigger jammer to be able to jam that, but that's also very, very vulnerable without any kind of protection. If you're talking about other types of services, PNT, you know, position, navigation, and timing services, that could be serviced through LEO, through low Earth orbit. There are a few great solutions out there, like Iridium-based navigation and other types of services that could be accessed from low Earth orbit. Then the problem with these things, again, is usually that the receiver is not a commodity like GNSS, right? It's always a factor of scale. So GNSS has become very, very cheap, and you can buy fantastic receivers now for a few dollars because of its scale. So these things are still expensive. Usually, to be able to get service for these things, you need to pay either a monthly fee or a per usage fee, again, which is still expensive. And like I said before, even when you have signals coming from low Earth orbit, they're still vulnerable to attacks. So I wouldn't say that this solves the issue completely.
At the end of the day, one of the problems of those selling GPS denied navigation have in the industry side is not enough of today's manufacturers or service providers consider GPS jamming to be a great enough risk for them to invest in this to be able to make it a large viable market. Is that the case? Or am I overstating that?
As I said before, you know, I've had a few conversations with leaders of the commercial drone, especially the delivery drone industry. They're always saying, hey, you know, I have a million concerns in my head. This is one of them. It's an important one, but it's one of them. And I have to pick and choose what to invest in right now. And usually what is most important to these guys is to get certification. And yes, whatever means they need to get certification, they're going to do. And I think one, you know, this is like in the automotive industry, right? In the beginning, when they built cars, they didn't mandate seatbelts. Why? Because again, nobody needed
seatbelts. Wasn't their biggest concern.
Exactly. Right. Wasn't their biggest concern. And much like, you know, after they invented I think it was Volvo that invented the seatbelt. After they invented it, they started mandating it because they understood that this can save a lot of problems if they have this in each vehicle.
There's kind of a cost consequence dynamic taking place here. Right now, the costs are so great, but the consequences are not the greatest concern. However, the closer we get to autonomy, the closer we get to GPS jamming, exactly, have a significant consequence, either because of the number of vehicles in the air or, you know, how they're being flown, then it becomes a much, potentially much bigger deal. But is that kind of the challenge in the marketplace today?
Well, I would say that, you know, one of the reasons why we're very focused today on military government applications is because they are very, very conscious of the pain, because they have been executing and delivering autonomous capabilities for quite some time. They understand the meaning of having one of the fundamental capabilities being denied. And definitely they are aware of the pain. And the commercial side, they're still not completely aware of the pain. And as you said, it's very early days. And when we're going mm-hmm. to start seeing more and more autonomous capabilities, then we're going to start, I wouldn't say, we're going to start seeing drones fall like flies, dead flies from the air. But definitely we're going to start seeing more and more accidents that are very, very probably the result of GPS integrity being impaired. That's when we're going to start seeing people raise the issue, either from the regulatory side mm-hmm. or from the industry side, because you're never going to have, if you're a great retailer that wants to start delivering stuff with a drone, you don't want your brand name slapped on a drone that's crashed right now on a bus stop.
So DoD in the US, but certainly militaries worldwide, are obviously very, very cognizant and aware of this problem, and they're investing in systems that help locate sources of GNSS jamming, like electro-optical or synthetic aperture radar, or all kinds of RF monitoring, whether from space or terrestrial. Mm-hmm. How are these interferences mapped, and is detection of GPS interference becoming more important than the actual consequence of jamming? So if you have some knowledge mm-hmm. ahead of time, then is it good enough to know that there is some interference going on so that you can adjust? Or do you have to go and actually directly address it?
Well, I mean, that's a really, really good question that we started asking that question about a year and a half ago. And I'll get to what we decided to do as a result of that. Most of the tools today in government and defense are, let's call them high-end, high-power detection capability tools that are run by the DODs out there. Intelligence gathering sensors that could be placed, for example, on the border of Israel, try to detect national level jamming threats. And those are the ones on the ground. The ones on, in space, there are a few great companies out there that, launch satellites in low Earth orbit and can detect, again, high-powered interferences and even triangulate them, as you mentioned, to be able to give you a sense with an inaccuracy of a few kilometers of saying where that high-power jammer is located at. And I think those are both fantastic approaches. But as I said, those are good approaches when you're trying to detect jamming at a national level. Those capabilities will not solve the problem of an idiot using a $20 jammer to bring down a power station or a drone just because he wants to. So, I mean, much like the automotive industry that started investing heavily in being able to provide cyber protection against an idiot hacker that decides to hijack a vehicle or just to have fun and be able to hack into it and control it. In our case, in GPS, you don't have to be a sophisticated hacker to bring it down. You need a finger and be able to press that button of the jammer. So I think the threat is a lot more imminent than the theoretical cyber threats of automotive industry. So what we decided to do is we decided to not only develop our GPS protection capabilities and our solution that can fit on a drone and be able to provide protection for GPS. We decided also to develop a capability of sensing attacks and being able to provide information or a service that allows you to monitor where those attacks are taking place. So basically what we decided to do is we said, hey, can we develop IoT-based sensors that we can deploy either on a drone or on the ground or on a vehicle and start collecting information that's available to everybody, right? So it's just freely available information, detect, analyze, characterize those attacks and provide that information to you if you're running a fleet of drones or a fleet of cars or critical infrastructure as to where you're seeing GPS integrity being challenged. So at the very least, as you mentioned, maybe that won't keep your platform protected, but definitely it'll give you basic information at least where you shouldn't fly into, because we believe that's the very, very minimal capability you need in order to ensure a safe, let's say, zone that you try to operate GNSS-based applications.
All right. So when it comes to alternatives, we mentioned a few. One can complement the GPS signal or perhaps even use as an alternative positioning, navigation, and timing signal with terrestrial radio signals, with fiber networks, with, you know, you mentioned Iridium satellites, but some of the other lower Earth orbit constellations as well, Wi-Fi, cell signals for localization, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it comes down to scale. And how do you achieve that and implement that technology at a price point that is compatible with the business cases that people need in the drone space, in particular on the commercial side?
Correct.
And that's still something that needs further maturing. There has been a National Timing Resilience and Security Act back in 2018 that instructed the Department of Transportation, the agency that's responsible for civilian GPS, to provide a complement and a backup for this GPS service. Yet, you fast forward, not much progress has been to date, at least, at least not to my knowledge. So you got to ask the question of, yes, the perception of the risk versus the practicalities of implementing any new solutions and alternatives versus the cost and occurrence and severity.
I couldn't agree more. As I said, I don't think it's a one size fits all. I don't think that the same approach would be taken if you're talking about a $5,000 dinner delivery drone and, an eVTOL that is delivering people from San Francisco to Los Angeles. I think you need to talk about different levels of safety. But definitely, you know, at the very least, we should be able to understand where your operations could be compromised, where their integrity could be compromised, and to be able to act upon them, all the way up to, as I said, you know, resilient navigation capabilities, which integrate and fuse different layers of, you know, navigation capabilities.
How do the regulators, both the FAA and EASA, look at GPS vulnerabilities in the context of drones, of civil drones? Do they give GPS issues enough importance in this overall system level risk assessment?
Well, I have to say that EASA is a little bit lagging in that department. And I think unlike previously where EASA, again, from what I understood, sometimes went head to head with FAA on a lot of things, I think on the drone space, EASA has decided to basically, like much like the Israeli equivalent, the Commercial Aviation Organization in Israel, they're basically waiting on FAA to decide what are the regulations and standards. And then they're going to basically adopt that. In terms of FAA, February 2020 was the first time that actually regulators came and said, called out for what is called responsible use of GPS or PNT. Executive White House Order 13905 that was issued back in February 2020 called for responsible use of GPS and PNT. Nobody really knew what they were talking about. So then, yes, DOT and DHS started to acting upon that and started to say, okay, we need information. They had tender to try to see other alternatives and other capabilities. But most of them allowed for alternative capabilities for stationary applications. You know, what happens if infrastructure lose their ability to get accurate time through GPS? Not a lot was relevant for drone and multi-copter navigation capabilities. But then I think the first ones that actually did something official was ANSI, American National Standards Institute, where they issued something called the Roadmap to UAS Standardization. This was in 21 already. They basically tried to map out what gaps there are right now in terms of technology and the industry to be able to achieve BVLOS and autonomous capabilities, beyond visual line of sight and autonomous capabilities. And they mapped out the gaps according to criticality or severity and priority as well. One of the top gaps that they mentioned is called Gap A8, which calls specifically for mitigating GPS jamming as an enabler to autonomous and BVLOS capabilities. And then come FAA, and FAA did the first thing in regards to, okay, what is needed to enable BVLOS? And they assembled ARC, right, Aviation Rulemaking Committee. And one of the things that they started by doing is looking at the ANSI roadmap to UAS standardization and to try to understand how to start bridging those gaps. I have to say it's very, very far from completion, this mission, according to what we understand it. standardized. But as I believe, the way to standardize this issue, that the FAA will basically tap in one of the standardization bodies. It can be ASTM or SAE to come and say, okay, we need you guys to help us build a best practice and then a standard that helps us to mitigate and bridge one of those gaps that we talked about in ANSI's roadmap. And FAA can come and say, okay, so in order to go BVLOS, you need to adhere to or comply to that standard.
Let's talk a little bit about the problem of GPS denied navigation. What are the different approaches to address it, both in the civil and defense markets?
It really depends what the application is. If the application is visual line of sight and you can see the drone that you're operating and UAV that you're operating, and I think that the problem is secondary. But when you go beyond visual line of sight, remotely piloted, and especially when you're trying to have one pilot control several applications, or sometimes have no pilot and have the applications try to act, you know, like a Roomba, go perform your application and come back to your base station, that's when you're starting to see the greatest dependency. And it doesn't matter if it's a commercial application or a defense application. In the defense application, they do have different approaches of how to try to mitigate that problem. And I think if in the commercial space, the liability is to have the drone crash on somebody's head, in the defense space, the liability is, or the problem or the concern is to have the drone crash beyond enemy lines, not complete their mission, and sometimes crash with very, very important payload. That's why sometimes they're willing to spend a lot more than what the platform itself costs in terms of being able to protect its ability to complete its mission. And the approaches are, much like I said before, are derived from different types and approaches of sensor fusion. The most common approach today is camera-based navigation. Very, very high-end cameras that are trying to solve this problem by being able to navigate, usually in a known terrain, sometimes in an unknown terrain, based on information and autonomous analysis that they're seeing from the field itself. Ergo, trying to calculate your own position according to what you see right now. As I said, this has an inherent problem because you need to see to be able to do that. So I'll give you the simplest example of when that is a problematic use case. It's a camera. If the camera gets dirty, or you have impaired vision, fog, clouds, rain, you can't see, or you can't see well, and that application immediately goes away. It really depends on the use case. Sometimes that's a great way to go. For example, if you want to track a vehicle or you want to track illegal activity, a camera or vision-based application is a great approach, much better than any kind of GPS-based approach. But when you generally just have to perform missions and have the ability to navigate autonomously, that's when you're going to need GPS information. And that GPS information can be backed and should be backed by other capabilities as well. It can be video, it can be radar, it can be an INS backing up and aggregating all of that information.
Let's talk about the lessons from the war in Ukraine as it relates to GPS resiliency and interference.
It's really interesting because, you know, even in the commercial world, we saw the impact of the war in Ukraine affecting in terms of, again, not taking anything for granted. And what we saw, actually, I think it was Hawkeye 360 who did a really great report and published it on GPS attacks being done by the Russians in the area of the Ukraine leading up to the Ukraine war. And what we saw over there is that, you know, it's been known for a long time that the Russians use GPS attacks to impair activities. And we see this in Israel as well. It's very well known that the Russians are supporting Syria. And we just issued in the company, we issued a report on, we collected information on what attacks we're seeing in the Golan Heights on the border between Israel and Syria. Like around Russia, we saw a very, very active attacks done by Russian jammers that affected sometimes kilometers and tens of kilometers away from the border. All the way, by the way, that even in Ben Gurion Airport, which is very far from the border, we saw commercial airliners being reporting GPS attacks and GPS integrity being impaired, landing down in Ben Gurion Airport. And we saw this in Europe as well, even before the Ukraine war. Finnair reported several problems, especially around Russia and the Black Sea, that again are probably being affected by military-grade Russian jammer. So what happened in the Ukraine was that the Ukrainians very early on understood that the drone is an unbelievable tool to help them protect their borders and to help them detect enemy activity. And they started flying them, and could be commercial drones or, you know, higher end military drones. And of course, the Russians, having known electronic warfare capabilities for a long time, tens of years now, immediately deployed their high-end military jammers. And obviously that was the easiest way for them, for the Russians, to be able to impair capabilities of the drone operations of the Ukrainians. And even when the Ukrainians received support by the U.S. government from high-end military UAV applications, those also, when meeting a GPS, a high-end GPS jammer, definitely caused them to impair their capabilities. That's what we're seeing. And the interesting thing is that we're seeing this trickle down to definitely all of Europe. And quite recently, I was in Eurosatory, one of the biggest defense conferences. And you saw that the effect of the Ukraine-Russian war is affecting everywhere around Europe. And definitely even commercial players are understanding that, hey, sometimes GPS is not going to be there.
So what opportunities does this present to anti-jamming companies? So obviously it's a problem. They're not able to accomplish their mission. I would assume now the cost is not as great as the consequences. So what opportunities are there for anti-jamming companies? But what are the options now for anti-jamming for, let's say, the military?
Well, in terms of the opportunities that this presents, so definitely when we're talking about military applications, all of the MODs out there, if in the past they had very high-end UAVs, you know, $10 million UAVs or loitering munition or high-end drones, now they're trying to get everything to be a larger quantity, lower cost, and but still have the same capabilities or similar capabilities. And that's why cost effectiveness of any kind of solution is, it's not only important, it's critical, it's mandatory. And that presents a great opportunity for us at Infinidom, because what we try to bring to the game is what we call proportional defense. We try to be able to provide GPS protection, not only for high-end applications like fighter jets and helicopters, but also for fixed-wing UAVs, you know, class two, or even multicopters, large class one or class two multicopters. And as I said before, I think that the approach, and this is what basically we're doing with Honeywell, our partners, is we're trying to create a more holistic approach of combining not only GPS, protected GPS with our technology, but also with alternative capabilities like an INS, radar-based velocity system, etc.
Back of the envelope, what's the market right now for anti-jamming, I mean, today, and what do you expect it to be in 5 years for anti-jamming capabilities like you're doing at Infinidom?
Well, right now, the market, again, according to several reports, is around $4 billion. And
commercial and military?
Yeah, yeah. But it's almost entirely, about 95% military today.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the things that are going to change in the next few years. Because more and more applications, not necessarily military, are going to depend on, you know, autonomous capabilities to be able to deliver goods, deliver people, perform inspection missions, etc. That's when we're going to start seeing also the capabilities to protect that ability, especially in the commercial space, trying to avoid liability issues.
The consequence will be greater than the cost.
Exactly.
Right. Just a quick follow-up on Ukraine. You know, I've heard some folks say that the Russian GPS jamming effort has been less extensive than what people expected based on their overall electronic warfare capability. And they cite several reasons. One is that, you know, Russians may depend on the same GPS as well. And there's been evidence with Russian fighters that were downed to air defenses to carry handheld GPS receivers. Then if they go and capture certain Ukrainian infrastructure that's dependent on GPS, then certainly they don't want to compromise that infrastructure that now they operate. And then also, if they do employ high-powered GPS jammers, then of course those are very easily detectable and certain weapons can be sent their way. You know, do you agree with that? And in a conflict where both sides rely on GPS, to what extent can we expect GPS jamming in the first place?
First of all, I agree. I think that, you know, I expected a little bit more. I think in all aspects, again, I'm just an innocent bystander here. bystander here, but in all aspects, I expected a little bit more in terms of the capabilities of Russia, but also in electronic warfare. I think the first reason you've mentioned is, I think the primary reason, as I said, everything depends on GPS. Even when you're talking about Russian fighters that are using GLONASS as a default, they still use GPS. And sometimes when you jam GPS, you're going to jam GLONASS because they're very, very adjacent frequencies. But in regards to what kind of real interferences we can expect in the battlefield, hey, I mean, I'll give you Israel as an example. Israel has seen periodically GPS being compromised on its borders. And we're seeing this in the Gaza Strip, in the southwest of Israel. And we're seeing this in the Golan Heights and on the border with Syria and the border with Lebanon. And this doesn't affect only military applications that obviously are very, very affected by these. It doesn't matter if it's drone applications or UGV applications or whatnot. We're seeing this also affecting precise agriculture, for example. Crop dusters cannot perform right well when they're being compromised. Irrigation systems that are based on GPS don't work. Autonomous tractors don't work on the borders of Israel. And this doesn't happen once in a blue moon. This happens either daily or weekly.
It sounds like your market is getting bigger and more realizable as each day goes on. Okay, we're going to go into a lightning round because of time limitations. Okay, so listen, it's really interesting what Infinidome is doing. It's a really interesting market. It sounds like it's one where the value is going to become greater than the cost as the time goes on. So fast forward 5 to 10 years, what does the industry look like?
Well, I'm going to start with the military. I think that everything in military, we're going to take demand out of the equation. This is already being done today. It's going to be more so in the future. On the commercial space, we're going to start seeing delivery, more delivery by drones than by trucks or by people, because this has to be the reality because of the economics, pure economics.
And the jamming of GPS is going to become more, I'll use the word catastrophic as an extreme, to these people. So they have to have some kind of anti-jamming capability or something other than GPS to navigate.
Exactly. As I said, it's like a chicken and the egg story, right? I mean, the more applications we have out there dependent on GPS, performing autonomous missions, the more we're going to start seeing disruptions bringing down these applications, the more it's going to hurt everybody around. We're going to need to see protection.
Our entrepreneurs have heard a couple of things in this podcast. I have, where I was thinking, if I were a small company in this space, here's a nice opportunity. What advice would you give to someone who's starting a company in, listen, advanced air mobility overall or in this world of jamming or anti-jamming?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's tough. I wouldn't recommend it to everybody because, we're in the neighborhood of 10,000-pound gorillas, big, big companies with vast capabilities and vast experience. And we're a little, fly on the windshield trying to make it. And the first thing that I had to understand is that, there's no second opportunity for a startup. A hardware startup, and definitely a hardware startup that dares to do something in the defense, homeland security, EW space. And that's why build your things, try to stay in stealth mode and launch when you're ready. Yes, go to market or time to market is very, very important. Try to be able to have the right partners on your side. We were fortunate enough to have a great company like Honeywell support us quite early on. And, thanks to them and together with them, we believe that we're extremely well positioned to be able to disrupt this market.
What's the one industry dynamic that could change that'll catapult your profitable growth?
Definitely commercial drone space. I think it'll come a lot sooner. The eVTOL space, trying to fly people unmanned. Mm-hmm. But when we're going to start seeing eVLOS being enabled and being able to deliver goods, in the United States and everybody will follow suit, that's when we're going to start seeing regulators starting to care. And I believe at the very least, monitoring and being able to detect where these attacks are taking place, which is a service we plan to launch next year, will be mandatory. And to some extent, some applications, some platform are going to need protection as well.
Homer, you've been a great guest. What would be the one message you'd like to leave for our audience?
Don't trust anything. Test, and test again. Don't count on GPS to always be there. Think about, ask yourself, what if? I'll be more than happy to talk to anybody who wants to discuss that.
Domer, thank you very much for the wonderful discussion, for being our guest on the show.
Thank you very much, Jim and Luca, for the opportunity. I'm really happy to speak with you guys. It's really fun.
All right, that's a wrap for today. Thank you for listening to the Vertical Space Podcast. Reach out if there are topics that you would like us to discuss, and goodbye until the next episode. Unless mentioned, this podcast is in no way endorsing or promoting any person and or company mentioned, and all opinions within the podcast are solely that of the presenters. The Vertical Space makes no guarantees, warranty, or representation of any information given in this podcast. Any information given is for informational purposes and should be used at your own risk. This podcast is for general, educational, and entertainment purposes only.